Good evening. I'm Mary Nichols, Dean of the College of Continuing Education, and it's such a pleasure to welcome you to this month's edition of Headliners. This week's presidential primaries demonstrated that Latinos now constitute a powerful voting bloc in this country, and that one of the key issues facing the candidates is in immigration. While a heated debate over immigration raged in the mainstream media, tonight's speaker embarked on a most rigorous research project to find out how ordinary citizens really feel about the issue. Last July, Luis Mendoza began a road trip around the perimeter of the country to study firsthand how immigration is affecting national identity and culture. Over the next 6 months, he circumnavigated the country by bicycle, traveling 70 miles a day instead of 70 miles an hour, right? Through small towns, major cities, and rural communities, observing what he calls the Latinoization of America. During this time, he had the opportunity to talk to hundreds of people at every stage of immigration and citizenship, and he kept a fascinating blog of his trip. There he gathered a wonderful collection of stories that offer a very unique perspective on this country's largest ethnic minority. Along the way, he also captured the imagination of the national media, which followed his journey through all 35 states. Professor Mendoza just returned from his trip on December 20th, and we're fortunate to have him with us this evening to share some of his findings. Luis Mendoza is second-generation Mexican-American. His grandparents came to this country at the turn of the last century, and he grew up in Texas, where he earned a PhD in literary and cultural studies from the University of Texas at Austin in 1994. He taught at the University of Texas at San Antonio, where he also served as Associate Dean of Liberal Arts and Fine Arts and as Interim Director of the Hispanic Research Center. In 2004, he joined the faculty of the University of Minnesota, where he serves as Professor and Chair of the Department of Chicano Studies. He is the author of Historia, The Literary Making of Chicana and Chicano History, and he's the editor of two volumes of literature by immigrants and prison inmates. He is currently at work on a book about his journey across America. Please join me in welcoming Professor Luis Mendoza.
Thank you so much for that very kind introduction and for inviting me to be here tonight to share the story of my trip with you. And I will say that this is not I'm not doing traditional research. I'm not a social scientist. This was an effort on my part to move toward a different kind of research rather than just doing literary analysis, cultural analysis, studying static text. I decided that since coming to Minnesota a few years ago, I really could not get away from the issue of immigration and how it's changing the demography of this country, and Minnesota being one of those states that has experienced a drastic change in the demography. And so I decided to spend my time going on this trip that would take me, to force me to go slow, as Nichols said. When I decided to take this trip, I didn't even own a bicycle. I'd made the decision to take it, thinking that, knowing in me, for one part, that I had sort of the endurance gene in me. I used to be a marathon runner, and I just, spending as much time as a administrator and professor, had letting my exercise regimen get out of the way. So I decided to do something that would help me combine exercise and research and to move toward a new type of research that would also move me more toward my creative genres of writing, because that also had been a long endeavor of mine, is to move toward writing a more creative style. And I knew that, thinking back on one of the early lessons I learned that a famous German philosopher, Walter Benjamin, said, is the antidote is the best anecdote to history. That is, only in talking to people and gathering their stories can you really take away sometimes, get something different than the official story you get in textbooks and in headlines. And one of the concerns that it bothered me so much was that in the mainstream media, what we were hearing was sort of the extremes of the immigration debate, all these places where legislation had been passed against immigrants, denying the jobs or right to rent a place and such and so on and so forth. And I felt like I wanted to, but I knew differently from talking to people here in Minnesota and elsewhere, that in many places immigrants were actually helping save the local economy by coming into work, that people were actively recruiting them like they have for the last 100 years to come here and work certain professions that other people didn't want to work, or that there was a real demand for this kind of work. And so I felt like I needed to go out and search and find out for myself, talking to people from all walks of life, not just immigrants, but non-immigrants as well, not just recent arrivals, but people who've been here for generations. And because I do believe it's important that we understand that, you know, we all have an immigrant past here, one way or the other. And so I always like to put this in context, and so I'm going to have a few slides here that will provide some of that context for you. Oh, this is a little bit about my trip, because I did many times. The point wasn't to be a purist about this. I was, even though I was athletic and I did get in much better shape as throughout the ride, there were times I needed a ride, so I'd hitch a ride if my bike broke down. I definitely had to drive a car. There were times when it was just too dangerous an area to ride. But I also had to go to a conference one time, and I drove like 3,000 miles in a week to go back up to Philadelphia and come back down. But I did still see the country, and I still did talk to people. And when I had a car, sometimes I'd go out of the way to certain places that I knew were going to be a place important to go to. For instance, I went up to Philadelphia for a conference, and then I decided to drive over to Hazleton, Pennsylvania, which has been the sort of what they call the place of origin for these anti-immigrant local ordinances. And I went to go talk to people there. There were times, for instance, when I go into New York or Washington, D.C., where I felt like rather than spend a whole day trying to get through such a densely populated area, I would just take the subway or the train into town, and then across Lake Michigan on a ferry. I mean, those are the various modes of transportation. So as we all know, again, we call ourselves a nation of immigrants, but immigration can cause stress. And this is something that, of course, it has a historic legacy, too, not only our legacy of being immigrants, but the tension that comes with it. This is a 1903 cartoon, and we can see asking the same question then, you know, is the immigrant an acquisition or a detriment, a liability or a benefit? And again, in a more modern cartoon that might ask us, put some perspective on this. And one can find, I have a whole collection of these cartoons on immigration going back for the last century, and that's really amazing. That itself tells a pretty fascinating story about the role of newspapers in shaping popular opinion and or trying to resist it. I won't go into great detail here, but I would just say, one studied the history of immigration in this country, you learn that over time there have been many cases in which different groups come here and they're, you might call, racialized. That is, we know of the tensions that came with the Irish coming to the U.S. In which they were denigrated, with Germans in the efforts to sort of stamp out the German language because there was fear that it would take over the English language. The 1882, it becomes racialized in a slightly different way, the Chinese Exclusion Act, and so on and so forth. And it's important to keep in mind that with the Mexican Revolution, we can sort of see the seeds of today in terms of what was going on here in the United States was the Industrial Revolution. And there was about a million people of Mexican descent came to the United States during this era. Not only were they leaving the social and political turmoil in their country, but they were being actively recruited here. This is the origins of people of Mexican descent here in Minnesota, as you know, a founding in St. Paul. They come to work in the sugar beet industry and the railroad industry. But oftentimes, under economic duress, we see desire to push people away. And so this is in the 1930, we see the Depression-era deportations. And then, of course, during World War II, we had the establishment of the Bracero program, which was, again, with the need for more labor in the fields and elsewhere, particularly in the agricultural fields. There was a special program created to bring in farm workers. And it lasted for 22 years, but some people have pointed out that, in fact, that we continue to have it today because we still depend on those laborers to come in and to meet our needs in the agriculture industry. And then in 1950s, under the Eisenhower administration, there was what was called Operation Wetback, again, an effort to push back immigrants to their home countries. Again, I won't go into great detail here, but just to keep these things in mind, some of the specific things, and especially, I guess I would like to point out two things in particular. One is the U.S. interventions in Latin America, which doesn't get a lot of play cause of immigration here, but I think it's very important to keep in mind if we think about the fact that there have been over 100 interventions in Latin America in the last century alone, that the social and economic turmoil that these countries experience is often a consequence of our desire to control the economies and the politics of those places. And people oftentimes come to the places of power. This is what we see going on throughout the relationships between the first and the third world throughout the world. The immigration, what's occurring now is really a global phenomena of migration to the first world, because this is where the resources are. And of course, today, well, we have what we call a new geography or new geography of Latino migration, and that is that Latino immigrants are going to places in the United States that they didn't really used to go to. Here's some basic facts. If we look at about the nation's largest ethnic minority, 1 out of 9 Americans is now Latino. But Latinos are still geographically concentrated in the Southwest, in the Southeast, and the Northeast. There is a large number of recently arrived immigrants in the Latino community. Immigrants do, in a sense, by virtue of being having less income and lower educational levels, they do lower those averages. But they are dispersing throughout the country. They're integrating culturally, and they're also integrating economically. There's all kinds of evidence that shows that there's a growing Latino middle class. And part of the reason I point that out is because there are these ideas that proliferate about Latinos somehow standing out and not wanting to be part of this country. One of those is language. Well, I can all kinds of evidence will show you, and my experience certainly bore this out, is that what new immigrants want, when they say they need assistance in integrating into society, what they want more often than anything is to learn, is assistance in learning English, because they know that English is the language of the economy, the language of social mobility. And they understand that. But in fact, many of those resources have been taken away to offer that assistance. And yet there are people in small towns and other places that are gathering together and helping them learn on their own. Latinos also have the second highest rate of intermarriage next to Asian Pacific, intercultural marriage next to Asian Pacific Islanders. That obviously shows that folks are getting along in some way, right? And then Latinos are highly entrepreneurial. Of all the ethnic minorities, they are the most entrepreneurial. And I have some data on this, which I'm not going to show tonight. But I did want to, again, when we talk about the kind of work and how it sort of helps sustain the economy here in very basic fundamental ways, here's a list of the top 10 employment niches that Latinos fulfill. Construction, restaurant, fruit and vegetables, preserving, landscaping, travel accommodation, service industry, private households, and so on. And we look at the new demography. Again, this data is a little bit older. I mean, it's from the last census. But Minnesota is amongst the top 10. We had 166% growth here. If you look at a place like North Carolina, again, the traditional – many of these places are in the traditional South. North Carolina, 394% growth in that 10-year period. And nothing shows that these trends are slowing down. And this will give you an idea of where people are going. This is the 23 states where Latinos are the largest minority group. And, of course, keeping in mind that some of these places, you're talking about, it's still a very small number, 1 and 2, 3%. Before I get into just a couple, here's some key ideas that I noticed on my trip and how that I learned from. Even though I knew some of this, the facts around these, having talked to people and had conversations with people about this, it was really important for me to understand. One is the importance of the 1986 immigration reform for allowing migrants who received legal status to enter into the labor market in a competitive way. And that changed that affected the new demography and the new geography, because when people felt that they could go get jobs elsewhere, they would go prove themselves as good workers, and then their employers would say, you know, we need more people, to help, you know, please. And they would often receive incentives, whether it was signing bonuses or raises or special incentives for bringing family members or friends. And so that would then create chain migration from other parts of Latin America, wherever their hometowns happened to be. And that's how I came to understand how the new geography has occurred. Again, it's important, and it was really insightful and profoundly insightful for me to learn from people these other elements of this. The out-migration of local groups and an aging and low-growth population lead local businesses to depend on foreign labor. That is, many of this generation's young people do not want, no longer want to do the work that their parents do in these small towns. They no longer want to work in the farm industry or in the timber industry. They decided to take advantage of an education and enter into a different kind of professional class. And that has led these towns to be facing the dilemma of either really imploding because they would have no local economy, or seeking people to move in and do that work. And so there's an irony or a paradox in which it's the new immigrants who are helping to preserve the lifestyle of the elders in these towns. And I found that to be really fascinating. And I found many people to be truly grateful. And what I came to realize is that even though there are about 100 small towns in this country that have passed these local anti-immigrant ordinances, there are really literally probably thousands of small towns that do no such thing, that they recognize and the contributions that these new immigrants make, and they appreciate it. So that's very important. I also found how important it is for the local leadership to set a positive or negative tone for how new immigrants are received. And this could include politicians, civic leaders, law enforcement, religious leaders, and so on. Again, I do find that we have, in fact, experiencing a different level of immigrant. Even though they often come in and are doing manual labor, they often are much more educated. It's that the economies in their home country can no longer sustain employment for them. And so we have a class of immigrants who actually have oftentimes much higher degree of education than past immigrants. I witnessed all over the country this intense entrepreneurship of the Latino community. Certainly, I still saw and talked to people who are experiencing the fragmentation of families. Again, certain classes of people play a very important role. And there is a sense in which people have responded to all these local ordinances and all the debates and all the talk in which they feel like the entire Latino community is being cast in a suspect light, and it has really intensified a sort of sense of racialization of this sort of us versus them attitude that has made people feel very wary, and I think it's been very bad for race relations in this country. Okay, let me talk about the trip a little bit in more detail. Being on the road was a very interesting experience. Again, I did train some before I left, but it's one thing to go out once a week rides and build up my distance and stamina. It was another thing to go day after day after day. And again, it's one thing to train on the beautiful bike trails we have here in Minnesota, and it's another thing to be out on the road. And so I was constantly obsessed the first few weeks, with what the shoulders look like. Were they going to be? Were they going to feel safe? How wide were they going to be? How much room between me and the cars? And that was something that I couldn't help but be constantly aware of. And even as I was experiencing, the beautiful part of being in our environment. And that was, I guess, something else that I wanted to experience along the way, because people always ask me, why by bike? Well, one thing was to move slow. The other thing was for the exercise. And the other thing was that I felt like it was important, there would be a benefit for me to experience a sustained way the natural environment we live in, the climate, the terrain, all those things, because that is the context of immigration in this country historically, is that people have moved across the land slowly and from their home country. And so I felt like I would gain a greater appreciation for that experience, however difficult it was. And I think I did. I think it was many days that it was terribly difficult and tiring and hot. I mean, there was a day in Redding, California, where it was 117 degrees. And But I also experienced the daily wonder and beauty of the sunsets and those gorgeous mountain scenes and such. And I'd gone hoping to camp a lot, and instead I found it very difficult to pace my rides with where campsites were. So I did sleep outside some. I did sleep in rest stops, but I stayed in motels a lot more often than I would have liked. Here's an interesting example of cultural adaptation and exchange. I mean, we all know that over time, immigrants tend to adopt some of the culture and habits and lifestyle and so many things of their new host country. Well, I was in Cottage Grove, Oregon, And I went to breakfast in one diner in the center of town, and it was a very typical, you know, all-American diner. And I went in there and opened up the menu, and I saw they had a Mexican breakfast insert in there. And I thought, well, that's interesting. I hadn't really been around. I had just gotten in the night before, and I didn't see any Latinos in town. Then as I was leaving, I started going to the other side of town, and I saw that, okay, well, here's, you know, there's some stores and some other things. And I saw this mural of the Virgen de Guadalupe on the side of a store, and I thought, well, let me go see, talk to these folks. And so I went in there, and I asked to speak to the owner and the two ladies in there who were Anglo. They said, oh, he's not here. And I said, well, can I talk to the owner? Is he Latino? I mean, I said, oh, is he Latino? And he said, no, he's not. He's white. And I said, oh, okay. Well, can you tell me a little bit about that mural you have outside? And they said, well, he's had a really rough life, you know, and he's, you know, been in and out of trouble and all kinds of things. And he's learned from our new neighbors here about the Virgin, and he adopted her as his saint, and she's really helped him, he said. And this was his way of paying tribute to her. And so then, again, an interesting example of how cultural accommodation and adaptation works both ways, right? Sometimes on a map, when you're traveling like this, you can't always trust that you're going to find something that's at a certain town. Again, Emblem, Wyoming, a population of 10. I didn't get to have lunch there like I thought I was going to. Some of these are just beautiful scenes. I went to out of my way to go to this internment center, detention center for Japanese during World War II. It's near Twin Falls, Idaho. And because I felt like, you know, it made me think about what does it mean when a nation, you know, fears people within its own borders so much that it perceives as other. You know, and I thought, you know, I sort of needed to pay homage to this experience as part of our national experience. There were times when I broke down, but I learned from each experience that no matter what happened, I used it as an opportunity to gather evidence from people. I was in Big Horn Mountain in Wyoming, and my derailleur broke down, so I couldn't switch gears. And I was on this 27-mile incline and about halfway up, and I did not want to go back down because I still have to go back up. And the little town I came from, there was nothing there, literally. And I called around. I called my office, and they called me back, and they said, well, we got you help. And I said, okay, because I had asked them if they'd get me a cab. I didn't care what I had to pay. And instead, she said, the state trooper's coming for you. And I said that there was, like, the only possibility. And the state trooper was pretty grumpy with me. I'm not very happy or impressed, but, you know, I decided that part of this trip was also to put myself out there more in terms of just, like, being more sociable and talking. And so I just started talking to him, and eventually it turned to an interview with him, asking him about, I'm going to play this in the background. Eventually he decided, after we got to talking and having a good conversation, oh, it's not showing. Oh, okay, that's interesting. Okay, well, let me go back. I'm sorry, I had a little video, and I hope that, you know what?
I had to lower the settings one time to use this. I don't know if you can.
Is it showing here?
Yeah, it's showing here.
Play it here, and then we'll switch it to those.
Oh, what's that?
You hit play, and I'll switch it to those.
Okay.
Maybe.
Well, anyhow... I eventually ended up interviewing him, asking him, you know, just by talking to him about his experience of being a trooper at first. And then eventually I got around to asking him about what the experience was, their experience with immigration in Wyoming. And he had, you know, some fascinating things to tell me about how they were really needed there. There was lots of work in the ranching industry, in the sheep industry, in places that other people kind of worked that they didn't want to do and that they were really welcome. He also told me that in his hometown of Worland, there were only 5 restaurants there, and they were all Hispanic food. And he said, so this became the place where they went and people interacted and met with other people, and that these are family-owned restaurants, so this is how they met new friends and new neighbors.
Okay, now I think we might be able to do that.
Oh, okay. Oh, that's interesting. So it's going to be awkward. Okay. Well, he decided when he became a little more amicable with me, because he wanted to take me back 45 miles and And I really didn't like the idea of doing that, because then even then I was going to have to go and catch a bus or rent a car to get my bike fixed. So he said, well, can you still ride your bike? I mean, will it still ride, or is it completely broken? I said, well, no, I just can't change gears. And he said, well, how about if I take you up to the top of the mountain, and then you can roll down 40 miles to the next town? And so I said, well, you know, my philosophy has always been to move forward, so sure. And he had been the third person who told me, if you can just get to the top of a hill, you can roll down. Well, it wasn't quite as easy as he made it out to be, because there were still times when it went up and down. But there were great stretches, like this was part of like a 12-mile stretch downhill. And you pick up really fast speeds. This may not seem like it, but I'm going about 37 miles an hour here. And on a bike, that can feel pretty scary for a long period of time, when I'm also riding the brakes at this speed. I mean, but it was fun at the same time. And that was always the payoff, because one thing I didn't think about very carefully, and I should have, was that I didn't plan to look over the topography very well. And so when I first started, I went through several mountain ranges in Northern California and Oregon and Wyoming. And I probably wouldn't have done it if I had thought about it too carefully. So in a way, it was good. There's a funny little scene here. I think it's coming up, where there's a deer that jumps up right in front of me. See it? Okay. So sometimes I felt like I was on a typical summer vacation. It was funny, but I also, you know, I kept constantly thinking, what is the connection here to what I'm wanting to research and find? And going along, I've come across historical markers like this, the immigrant trails, and think about the terrain that people had to pass. Again, an example of a cultural parallel. In Wyoming, I kept seeing this Crazy Woman Creek, Crazy Woman Mall, Crazy Woman Store, and I was like, what is this about? And I finally was able to ask someone who told me it was about a myth of a woman who had been abandoned by in a pioneer trail, and supposedly she had had an affair with an Indian man, and her husband had left her and taken her and his kids, and they left. And so this reminded me of the legend of La Llorona in Mexican, primarily Mexican, but also Central American history and culture. And it's a very similar parallel, but it's about this notion of female abandonment. And again, I wondered if any of them had ever heard of that up there, but just this interesting parallel, I thought. Again, seeing these amazing monuments at the same time, thinking about how the man who built Mount Rushmore, the lead sculptor, was a nativist, and doesn't get necessarily highlighted a lot, but I found it interesting that one of his workers was hired then by native peoples to build this monument to Crazy Horse. And he was recent immigrant, and his family has now been working on this monument for, this is the third generation. I'm going to speed along here a little bit, so I can get to, but these are some of the people I met. And again, in Worthington, this is Minnesota here, it was interesting because I was stopped by this one police officer for riding the wrong way on the sidewalk. And it was interesting because all over the country, I was getting stopped in small towns. It was just very strange. It was like, okay, the stranger in town, you know, what are you doing? How long are you going to be by police? And I found that very odd and somewhat frustrating and annoying. But I learned after a while just to turn it into an opportunity to interview them. And so by this time I was already getting good at it. And this guy was, again, seemed grumpy with me at first. And I just, you know, I started asking him. He called up his friend, and they were just so enthusiastic to talk about how in Worthington they receive incentive for learning Spanish, that they really believe in being part of the solution, not part of the problem there, that they will not participate with ICE, and so on and so forth. And he talked about all the things that are being done to help the families in the aftermath of the raids on the Swift plant there and so on. One of the things I noticed in some of the inner cities was that there was many Latino communities are experiencing issues with gentrification. And this was true in places like Chicago, New York, but also along the border. And I thought that was interesting because along the border, that gentrification is happening because people are starting to knowing that there's going to be a need for more official ports of entry as a result of the border wall being built, people are starting now wanting to buy property along the border, hoping that they can develop the land as a new place of commerce. In Canada, it's interesting. One of the first places I went through Canada from Detroit to Albany, and I met this young man at a store there. He was Mexican. He started talking to me, and turns out he had been an undocumented immigrant here in the United States. And he said it was too stressful for him. He went back home, and then he found out about this program that would take workers to Canada and pay their way there. And he got a signing bonus. And, you know, and so there was a whole group of men who lived there. And he said it was primarily men, and they worked. And it turns out Leamington, Canada, is the sort of tomato capital of Canada. And they're also doing construction work there. But I met Latinos from all different backgrounds, from Cuba, from Honduras, from Costa Rica, El Salvador, Guatemala, some parts of South America, Peru. Here's a place in East Boston that I found this mural very interesting, because it really seemed to take pride in the fact of its immigrant heritage there, and had this little bit of all of that history on this wall. In New York City, I met a number of people there, and one professor there took me to this park in the bottom left-hand side there. That he said it was, you know, interesting phenomena. If you went there, it was all these African and Latina immigrant women who were basically doing the babysitting, the daycare for women who are mostly white, you know, while they were there for the work. And you could just see this evidence. I tried to talk to some of them, and most of them were pretty wary of talking to me. I did interview three of them, but they would not allow me to record them or take their pictures or anything. But I did find this phenomenon very fascinating. Let's see. This is in Trenton, New Jersey. I met this guy. His name is Caesar. He's from Guatemala, and he had a pizza shop called Latino Americano Pizzeria. And I went in there and I asked, and you know, I looked at the menu, and it was typical, you know, Italian fare. And so I started talking to him, and I asked him, I said, why don't you open a Guatemalan food store? And he says, well, because I don't really cook, you know, Guatemalan food. I came here in the United States 17 years ago, and I worked for 14 years at a pizza restaurant. So this is what I know how to do. And so I thought that was pretty fascinating. I met this man, Ed Landa, who was a PhD graduate in physics here at the U of M, who found out about my blog and wrote me and said, when you come this way, I want to take you around Langley Park. And anyway, he spent a whole afternoon with me, which was really nice. And at the end of the day, I asked him, I said, Ed, you know, why did you take the time to show me around and do this? And he said, well, he goes, you know, he said, I'm so bothered by the time by the fact that so many people, you know, I'm a second generation, you know, Russian Jewish immigrant. And I'm so bothered by the fact that people think that we have an immigrant history, but now that I'm here, we can close the door behind us. And he expounded on the fact that he didn't agree with every, you know, all the Latino politics or every issue and the way it got discussed, but he just felt like we had to have a more humane and civil dialogue about it. And so, I appreciated him taking the time to spend with me. Going through New Orleans was fascinating. You could definitely see the new influx of Latino immigrants into the area, doing all kinds of work in creating new businesses, but also entrepreneurs like this, like Ezekiel, who owned a little taco truck, and I found him outside of a day labor site at a day labor site, and he said he'd been there a year, and that he'd gone from, you know, selling tamales and tacos in a bucket to then owning a little car where he went around to several sites, and then to where he was able to buy a truck. And I asked him, I said, well, how is life here for you? You know, has it been worth it? And he said, oh, yeah. He goes, you know, in Mexico, life is anywhere from a 10 to a 70. You know, it just changes all the time. And you know, he said he had an accounting degree, but he wasn't able to keep his job there. He says, but here, life is 100 because I can, you know, get up and I can work hard. And at the end of the day, I have money. And I can, you know, send my children to school. And I can hope for something better for them here. And to me, that sounded like a very typical immigrant story. Again, I was profoundly humbled by people taking time out of their work they were doing to talk to me all the time. And I was able to, I took a lot of video, a lot of audio recording, and often, but I wasn't holding up the camera to them, and I was using mostly the video function on my digital camera. So the angles are kind of weird. But one of the things that also Carlos was telling me about was how, he works at a farm worker, worker center right along the border in El Paso. And he said they're right next door to a border patrol station. And I don't know if you remember this old cartoon up here. I couldn't remember what it was, but it still reminded me of it, and I found it. Sam Sheepdog is that there's two sort of, I mean, what he told me was that, you know, that and the farm worker center is considered a safe haven where Border Patrol has agreed not to bother people that are there. They can hang out there. People can walk out of there and they happen to be undocumented, they're subject to arrest. But as long as they're there, they won't be hassled. And he said that they have this, you know, bizarre kind of coexistence with the Border Patrol who will, and it reminded me of this cartoon because it's this sort of thing where these two sworn enemies, they'll punch in, they each do their job, and then they kind of go about doing it at the end of the day, then they all go home. And it just seemed kind of a little bit bizarre, sort of surreal to me. I ended up, my last day, which I've not been planning, but December, when I arrived in Oakland, which is where I ended my trip, turned out to be International Migrants Day. And so some friends took me to an art exhibit, art opening that was going on, and it was just a great event, very big art exhibit, a photo exhibit, and celebration. And I guess I'll end there. I'll show you these questions, but I do want to hear your questions. And I'm going to let some pictures roll from the back. So let me just stop there and see if you have any questions.
Lewis, thank you very much. My goodness, I want to know how you took those pictures as you were flying down the mountain at 37 miles an hour. Hat?
Holding on to that camera.
And then stopped for going the wrong way on a sidewalk, riding the wrong way. You rebel, you, yeah. We have a question right here.
You wouldn't happen to have read Studs Terkel at the U, only because when I was here in 1957, that was SLA, and we did read Studs Terkel, and he did, similar to what you did, was called Work in America. And in when I returned to the university here in 1974 to finish my degree, which is now CLA, I did a paper on Sister Giovanni. And have you heard of her? The Gap House in West St. Paul?
I don't know Sister Giovanni. No, I do know Studs Terkel.
Okay. Well, Sister Giovanni's been gone quite a few years, but she got an educational system going on the west side of St. Paul. And it's called the Gap House, and there's still a lot of history there. In fact, it used to be Concord Avenue, and now they call it Chavez Avenue.
Right,
so.
Right.
When you've got some time, it's second generation or third generation Latinos there now. So.
Right. No, I'll look that up. Thank you so much. Yes, many people have told me that this project bears resemblance to Studs Terkel. I can only hope to live up to that. But yeah, and that's one of the interesting things. I was on the road. I was looking at a lot of different models for thinking about this. And I was mostly looking at travel literature in the U.S. And one of the things that's interesting is that I really only ran across, I think, one example of a piece of travel literature that was written by a person of color. You know, and so I just thought that was interesting because even though, again, wrote Travels with Charlie, so many other really fascinating books that I think I learned a lot from, I'm sort of looking at it from the other lens, you know, a different lens.
You mentioned the importance of leadership in setting the tone with regard to welcoming people. Would you like to comment on the leadership, political leadership in this state and in the nation now?
Yeah. Well, I do think, you know, many people have found this to be an easily, immigration to be a convenient wedge issue. I think they've exploited that, and I think it's worked to some extent. And I think our governor has been part of that. When, you know, again, it's no secret to anybody who's in the know about this that there was an intentional decision by the Republican Party to use immigration as a wedge issue a couple of years ago. And that's when we saw the governor come out with this haphazard report about the impact of immigration, sort of the cost of immigration in Minnesota, without any consideration of the benefit. And I think that that's, you know, again, a poor example of leadership. Because, again, I think you can have those debates, but they need to be reasoned debates. And reasoning involves considering both sides of any argument, right? And so I think it's a shameful act to do, to manipulate things like that. And so I do think that we see in both of the cities, you know, again, the police, and it's true around the majority of police stations around the country, do not want to participate with ICE because they feel like it's their job to protect the communities they live in, and to do so they have to have good relations. If you create such a hostile relationship that people are afraid of you, then they may not report crimes. You're less likely to be able to do your job of crime solving and crime prevention if you don't have good dialogue with communities. And it's not your job to do immigration enforcement. So, again, they resist doing that. So those are the two levels, I guess, I'd speak to in our state.
You've mentioned ICE a couple times. Can you define that?
ICE is Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's the, now I can no longer remember what the, I used to be, Immigration and Naturalization Service. ICE, is that when it was moved under the Homeland Security, it was given a new name. So now it's called ICE, yeah.
Very good. Question back here.
You were talking about non-Caucasian travel literature. One that comes to my mind is Blue Highways by William Least Heat Moon.
Yeah,
and you're familiar with that. But
that's the one I found.
but it's a great. It was my question really is the St. Paul paper here a few days ago. I think it was in the St. Paul paper, had an editorial, I think by Mr. Pitts from Chicago about the hyphenating of Americans, talking about African Americans and Mexican Americans, et cetera, Americans, and decrying that hyphenization, that after all, we are Americans. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it always needs to be historically contextualized. It would be great if we could ever, you know, move beyond the time when we had to be specific. And people oftentimes, you know, again, we can talk about the benefits and the problems associated with identity politics. You know, and I think it's important to keep in mind that many ethnic minorities in the country have felt the need to organize together to maintain a strong sense of identity and culture, often in the context of the fact that they have been isolated intentionally, that they have been forced to live due to segregationist policies, they have faced discrimination. So oftentimes that need to maintain a strong sense of cultural distinctiveness is a protective device against hostility, and I think that's really important. Again, if I'm somewhere, you know, if I go to Mexico, I may say Mexican American, but most people say I'm Americano, and that's what they'll understand. They'll look at me and know that I may be of Mexican descent, but I'm not Mexican, you know. And if I go somewhere else and travel in Europe, you know, I may say I'm Americano, but I may also explain what that means, you know, because people don't look at me and think typical American, you know. We still have, I think, in our mind's eye, and I ask this to my students all the time, and it bears itself out, you know, what does your typical American look like? And until that day comes when they are totally stumped, you know, I think we're facing something of that challenge, is that we are still, that identity is still evolving. And so I agree, ideally, that we wouldn't need those distinctive identities, but we oftentimes do. Or unless everybody said that, you know, because that would be the other way to think about it. I don't think that's going to happen. But why is it, you know, there were times when, there are times when different culture groups have had to hang on to that identity for a reason. I'll just leave it at that.
We have a question over here, please.
Yeah, I was wondering, did you perceive any striking differences or similarities among groups from Mexico versus Central America versus South America?
Can you be a little bit more specific?
Well, I don't want to generalize, and I don't want to view this community, you know, as a monolith, but I'm just wondering, people from different national experiences coming to this country.
You mean, but I guess that's what I'm asking. You're asking if I saw differences in the way they were...
In their perceptions or their values or...
No, not really, no. I mostly met people that were working class, but not entirely. I mean, I did meet some professionals and some who were very successful, but they all felt still a very strong sense, even once he'd been here for 15, 20, 30 years, they held on to that memory of their immigration experience as something that was difficult, that they were proud that they did, and they did it for their children, and that it bore out their hopes. So, I mean, that's the narrative they told me was about this struggle, how difficult it was to leave home, how oftentimes they felt like they had no other choice, and there was some struggle into the transition. There was a transition period where it was really hard or really scary, and times when they had to separate from their family for a while. But I didn't hear any striking differences amongst the different groups around that.
A question over here, please.
There seems to be this widely held perception that immigrants, at least the last decade, have a negative impact on the economy. Are there data out there or studies being done to offset this this perception, to in fact show the positive impact of immigrants on the economy?
There, I think, you're going to find... You'll find lots and lots of stuff out there. I mean, I look at stuff, what I find the most balanced stuff, and I realize it's not considered necessarily value-free, so to speak, is the Pew Hispanic Research Center. That just didn't sound right. The Pew Hispanic Research Center, they put out some what I consider to be pretty balanced and objective reports. Again, I know people sometimes take them to task, but they have some great stuff up there. There are other ones out there if you just search, then you can assess if you search on the internet, you'll find others. But I would say just consider the differences between them, the range of stuff that's considered and not considered in terms of the cost-benefit analysis, so to speak.
So there's no definitive data then?
I don't think so. I think it's just an ongoing debate about what's considered, what things you take into consideration and how you calculate the data and all that stuff.
Based on different studies and the interpretation is not value-free. Question back here in the center, please.
You mentioned you were working on a book. Is it a documentary or is it a work of fiction based on your experience? And who is your reader?
I want it to be... there's a genre of literature in Latin America, and it's becoming a little bit more popular here in the United States, called testimonial, which is sort of a first-person account of someone who seeks to be sort of representative of his or her people, so to speak. And, I initially entitled this my project, A Journey Across Our America. And, again, the Our America is simply... trying to wrap my hands around the fact that, there is this tension, us versus them, this historically and now, between, where Latinos fit in this country. And Our America is this title of an essay written in 1893 by Jose Martí, in which he was really challenging and really pointing out the fact that there are two Americas. And he was sort of challenging what he called Yankee imperialism to consider what it would be like to quit looking to Europe for its model and for what our culture and society should be like, and that we had all that it took to be created. We had our own ancient and beautiful history here in the Americas. And he said, there is our America and then there is your America. Why don't we think about what it bring it together? And I want to write this firsthand story about my trip. And I'm struggling quite how to figure out how to put other people's stories in there without it being too choppy. I want to use all these interviews that I get. I want other people's voices to come through. And so at this point, the journey itself will be, the structure of the book will be the journey itself, chronological. And then I'm thinking that certain themes that I want to write about I will use the interviews I had with people to put inserts, you know, however long necessary, in the middle of chapters, the end of chapters, and so on and so forth, so that their voices can come through. And that's my idea of it now. I'm not quite sure what will happen in the end.
Good luck with that. In the center here.
Okay. My question is, in your experience with interviewing the immigrant population or the, like, second or third generation, was there any specific issue that you heard about that they were probably struggling with the most, like, be it healthcare, education, or what did they see as probably this day and age the largest, I guess you could say, obstacle in America?
No, I think what they struggled with most was not the struggle to find work, not the struggle, the day-to-day struggle. I think they struggled with this mixed signals they got of, like, wanting, seeing the job opportunities, seeing the that their employers wanted them here, but then hearing all this negative stuff that made them feel that they weren't wanted here. And so I think that was very much this sense of, like, you know, I'm trying to survive. I'm doing what I need to survive for my family. But, you know, they didn't like this, what they felt was this sort of omnipresent hostility toward them.
I was just curious, and you mentioned that, for example, that in your experience or brief experience in Canada, that there was a much more welcoming atmosphere there. Would you characterize any differences in geographical changes? Or, you know, you've got some states like New Mexico where you've got a very large population of Latinos, and others like Minnesota where it's very small. How about geographical differences in the United States? Any to speak of?
Well, the experience is certainly different. I mean, I couldn't help, having been a student of what we call Chicano history of the United States, the history of having been well aware of the history of Mexicans in the United States, I'm struck by how the places that are experiencing this Mexican migration or Latino migration for the first time in the area, how much the challenges they face are still strikingly similar to the past. That is, on the one hand, the schools are struggling how to deal with ESL or EL education issues. The police, the hospital, the health industry, all these things are struggling with what to do with the need for bilingual speakers. Many of the local communities are feeling a lot of anxiety about the newcomers to the area. It's interesting to me that. And I guess on the one hand, it seems like, you know, okay, they're going through this for the first time. You know, it's not surprising that they would experience all these things. On the other hand, I wanted to ask, you know, can't you learn? Why haven't you learned from what's gone? You know, this has gone on before in other places. You know, what lessons could you have learned to help pave the way, make it smoother? So there are differences. I mean, certainly, again, the South. It's really interesting because. For the longest, in some of these states, you're now seeing the rapid growth of Latino immigrants that in a place that was traditionally thought of in a biracial terms, and now you have this new factor, and it's created tension. And sometimes, the new immigrants are being used as scapegoats for why African Americans aren't doing so well when they weren't doing so well before, you know. And so it's interesting, and I think that there's a lot of that going on as well. It's a convenient scapegoat for local problems.
It's in the back here.
Could you talk a little bit about, for instance, the School of the Assassins and the support by American politics of Latino dictatorships and how that has made it necessary for people to immigrate from their homeland?
Well, when I do a talk in a classroom or something, I'll often show that list of interventions. And again, it's not something that gets a lot of coverage in our history books or anything else. And, we can go back to just thinking about the Monroe Doctrine and how the U.S. sort of on the one hand said hands off to Europe about messing with other countries in the Americas, but basically used that as a way to say this is our backyard. And, you know, you go, I think you easily go back to what, well, let's just say the middle of the 19th century, I mean the 20th century, and look at how the U.S. participated in the assassination of the president of Guatemala, who was democratically elected. You know, we can look at, if you look, think back as more recently, most recently as the 1980s, when we had several, so we had support of civil wars in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Guatemala, with thousands of dollars going every day. I mean, so they're ultimately millions of dollars per year going in to support, I would say, support anti-democratic movements. That is, the desire for the U.S. to control, basically to have puppet governments there that would help promote the economic interest of the United States and the United States corporations. And so this, you know, this is something that has been a pattern, and over. You know, if we look at, it's kind of hard to talk about in a nutshell, but I'm just saying that the information is there. There's a bunch of great books out there you can find, and these are all, it's not hard to verify at all.
Question in the back here.
One of the things you touched on earlier was this tension that appears to be between the Hispanic and the Black community. And I'm wondering about the roots of that, and does that have something to do with the support, for example, that Hillary Clinton got in California from the Hispanic voters at 3-1 versus Obama?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually pretty I'm bothered by the media. What I feel like is really, and maybe it's not the media, maybe it's Clinton's campaign, but I'd rather think it was the media, that is sort of really trying to highlight this tension there. And no doubt, I mean, you could talk about different inter-ethnic tensions of some sort or another. You could think about it as, you know, is it really, I mean, what is it really based on? Or is it the kind of tension that many working class groups have against one another because they're often seen as competitors? I had appreciated, I don't know if you saw the debate between Obama and Clinton last week, and I really appreciated his answer when they tried to push this question of immigration, when he said, you know, it's a larger structural issue rather than a question of ethnic tensions, a question of competition amongst these two groups. And he tried, and I thought he did a great job of sort of saying, let's not scapegoat the problems with Latinos or Latino immigrants by saying that they're bringing this problem with the Black community, but in fact, let's talk about the economic problems and in a larger scale, which I thought was really important. There is some, there's no doubt that there is some tension there, and I think it's more longstanding. I couldn't tell you the roots of it. I mean, having grown up in Houston, I mean, I witnessed it there, but I'm not so sure. I mean, there's nothing I could point to that says, you know, this is the cause, this is the reason. I think it's, I don't know. I don't know if I could answer any deeper than that.
Do they think that the Clintons did a lot for that community?
Quite frankly, I've been talking about this with friends. I'm not so sure why she feels she can take the Latino community's support for granted. And I feel like she's talking as if she has, because I don't hear her saying much else about why Latinos should support her. I don't know. I have many friends around here who don't know. Maybe there's a lot of work she's done in other places like California that they've done. I honestly don't know.
There's a continuing discussion about NAFTA and how it affects Americans. How is the Latino community perceive NAFTA, and how has it affected their life?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a great question, and it's also in line with this whole issue of with intervention in Latin America. And I say that because these economic deals, they're often very one-sided. And it's no accident that in January 1st, 1994, with the implementation of NAFTA, that the Zapatista rebellion movement occurred. And they did so because they knew it would be bad for the economy and bad for people there. And one of the reasons it's bad is that with these trade agreements came changes in Mexico to the Constitution that actually took away land from indigenous peoples there, and so they could be sold to corporations. And in taking their land away, what happened is that people were forced to move to the cities where they couldn't find jobs as wage laborers, and so they became homeless, and so they're forced to migrate. And what you've seen since 1994 throughout Mexico and Central America where these trade deals exist is a rise in the number of indigenous peoples who've come to the Americas because they've had no alternative. And so, again, until we begin to think about what it means to have bilateral solutions to problems, they create bilateral opportunities that create, again, not just the opportunity for movement of money and materials, but also people, you know, we're not going to find solutions.
Within the Latino communities you visited or talked with, did you see gender differences in expectations and experiences?
Well, it's a good question. And it's interesting, part of me wants to say that I know there are differences, you know, I mean, no doubt, and I have friends that do that kind of research. But the people I talked to, it was oftentimes this kind of method of, I mean, I didn't have a plan when I went into a town. It was just like, if it was a small town, I'd sort of go to the middle and look at the main intersection and start from there. Sometimes I had a lead and would talk to someone. And so that when I had an extensive interview with a woman, it was, you know, very clearly it was a strong woman who was in some leadership position and had some great story to tell, and I appreciated the fact that she's telling me the story as a woman because, you know, I think that she was being extra courageous, probably doing extra work on top of everything else and all those sorts of things. But they didn't necessarily talk about differences in expectations. They were just as, or they were, if not more, committed than anybody else I spoke with. I heard some great stories of, for instance, this woman, Guadalupe Quinn, and again, it's just to give you an anecdote. In Oregon, in Eugene, Oregon, who told me that her family came to the U.S. as part of the Barceló program in the 1950s. She was born in Oxnard, California. Got married in the early 70s. She said she was this sort of typical young Mexican girl who married this Anglo man, and they moved up to Eugene to start a new life together. And she said a couple of years later, a friend of hers asked her to attend a meeting. This is the early 80s, I guess, to attend a meeting to be a translator because she knew she spoke Spanish. She said, sure. And it turns out it was a Quaker-sponsored meeting to talk about what to do about the U.S. involvement in Central America. And she says, as a translator, she was transformed because she had never heard of all this stuff. She'd never been critical of the U.S. government. And all of a sudden, she said her eyes opened to, you know, where America sat on some of these issues. And she said she never stopped, and that her, she said, you know, it was hard, but my husband had to realize that I was no longer going to be the woman he married. You know, I was going to become involved, and I was going to make this my work to sort of work for social justice, and that she's been doing that ever since. Again, I thought it was a fascinating story. You know?
Wow, powerful. Over here, please.
Can you explain the difference, if there is any, between the terms Chicano, Hispanic, and Latino?
Well, sure. Hispanic is what, a general reference to anybody of Spanish. Some has some kind of Spanish descent in them. It's many people don't like it because it's sort of a term applied to this community in the 70s by the Nixon administration, trying to find an umbrella term to work with the census. And so they feel like it's an outside, a term imposed upon them by the outside. On the other hand, the 80s came along, and you had the Hispanic generation heralded by the media. and it stuck with that whole generation of young folks. Latinos is oftentimes a more preferred term, operates the same way, although it definitely refers to more specifically to people from Latin America. It it's considered maybe more preferable because it has more, it's sort of a Spanish language term. While Chicano is much more specific to people of Mexican descent living in the United States, and it often denotes a strong ideology of ethnic pride and awareness of one's culture and history and civil rights. That's my most succinct definition I can offer.
And you chose Latino for your writing to capture that, frame it.
Right. I chose Latino because, I wanted to talk to people of all. I do think, and this is something in this day and age, talking about immigration, I can't just talk about people of Mexican descent.
Okay. In the back here, please.
Just to follow up on the fact that many indigenous people now from Mexico and Central America are coming here, were you able to encounter, my understanding is that there's a lot of communities where before we had, when these new immigrants come in, they had to find services and bilingual services, but now it's these people, some of these people, communities are not Spanish speaking. They speak an indigenous language, and that further, causes, problems. And there's fewer of those interpreters even. So, did you encounter some of those, communities? And another thing is, and just generally correlated with a similar, the big thing about immigrants and the thing that they were saying about Latino immigrants and not assimilate. Do you think that that's true, or do you find that not to be true?
Yeah. Well, regard to the first question, I didn't meet too many indigenous peoples that didn't speak English or Spanish. I know they exist. I mean, in the sense that I know that, for instance, here in Minneapolis, there's a Quechua church, that has services held in Quechua only. I know that they exist, and I know that they find new ways to get their needs met. I do think, from having talked to a couple of people that, and I couldn't tell you right off the top of my head what indigenous groups they're from, but that people did tell me a couple of instances that occurred, that oftentimes those people would attend the Catholic church, Spanish language services, even if they didn't speak the language because it was most familiar to them. I don't have a lot to say about that. Regarding the second question, what was it? Right. Okay. Well, again, I don't think it's, the traditional sociological paradigm about assimilation is always said by second generation they're assimilated. And in fact, evidence shows that Latinos don't necessarily follow that paradigm. But I also think that assimilation shouldn't be the measure. I don't think it's really the best measure of adaptation anymore. Because I think one thing about Latinos is that, and again, I would put it back into that context of having been experienced isolation, discrimination, and such. One thing that makes Latinos unique is that over time, they do tend to hold on to many of their cultural characteristics. And I think we live in a society now that I believe there's a lot of room for understanding, again, biculturalism, understanding that it's not an either or, that you can accept and accommodate to the ways of the mainstream society, even as you have some distinctive things about your own culture, maintain them. I don't think that it has to be, an either or. So assimilate is, I think, way too strong a word to talk about a one-way process. I think it works multiple ways. Just as, that one example I showed of cultural adaptation, that happens in myriad ways in across the country where people sort of also, you can look at some basic things and hate to be so trivial, but, salsa is the number one condiment. Tortillas are the second most form of white bread sold in this country now. I mean, those sorts of things. You know, adaptation, assimilation works both ways. I don't think it's a simple one unidirectional phenomena anymore.
We have a question in front here.
The journey that you took is quite extraordinary and quite unusual. I suspect there are two stories. One is the information that you received for your project, and the other is a personal story. Would you care to comment about the personal story of this extraordinary journey?
I had many people, because I kept this blog, and I'm glad I did, it gave me a sense of continuity and community along the way. Again, a funny little thing. There were several times when, just sort of out of the blue, when I was having a conversation with somebody about the bike ride, where they would, at least three times, somebody said, "You're like a Mexican Forrest Gump, huh?" And I said, "No." Well, I would say, "No." Then I thought about it. I said, "Well, you know," I said, "there's nobody following me." And then I realized that I had this community of followers on my blog, on the web, you know, and I thought that was, and I realized how important that was for me in some ways, because it was, you know, a lonely journey. It was a lot of solitude, and that was part of the personal challenge, even as at the same time I'd given myself the personal challenge that to do this and to do it successfully, I would have to be much more outgoing than I am normally. I mean, I can do public speaking and so on and so forth, but I can travel across the country and not talk to anyone and be perfectly fine at the same time. So I knew I'd have to really put myself out there more. And I knew I'd have to be, to humble myself when I needed to get, accept help and so on and so forth. And I found it very, very affirming that whenever I needed help, someone was there. And there are so many small, big and large instances of that, not just the police officer, but I could tell you of about five or six other times where somebody, you know, I was thinking about what to do because I was facing some kind of problem, and they'd say, "Hey, do you need a ride?" And I found that very, very affirming because I personally have been robbed by giving somebody, you know, a hitchhiker a ride. So I understand why somebody wouldn't. I found again, it was that thing of being with yourself so many. I mean, first it was a physical challenge, and then it turned into a mental and emotional challenge, you know, of just spending that much time by yourself, of the discipline of getting up the next day. And but I found it really beneficial. And I'm still trying to figure out how to articulate all those challenges at the many different dimensions. But, I mean, you're absolutely right. And that's part of it, too. I think that that's – I need to articulate that if I think I'm going to do justice to what the experience was.
Great question. In the back here, please.
Were you able to speak to any high school students of recent immigrant families, and what are some of their hopes or their fears as they grow up in America?
I did speak to a number of – well, I spoke to several – classrooms. I didn't always get to turn that into a personal conversation with some of them. I did speak to a young high school graduate in Melrose, Minnesota, and I was really asking her, because I had been shown around by a elderly couple who had actually moved to Minnesota in the retirement age to help. They said they sought out a community with new immigrants because they felt like they had a role to play in helping that transition. And they took me to this graduation because they'd been befriended by families, by quite a number of people in that town. And I'd asked them, I said, you know, what's this like about, because they had explained to me about how there were tensions there and how they were trying to be mediators and how there's a lot of anxiety amongst elders. And I asked, I said, what about young people? And so they said, well, you know, let's go to this young woman's graduation party. And so I asked her, I said, well, what's it been like for you? And I think she'd lived there, I don't know, 7, 8 years. And I said, you know, how do you get along with everybody? You know, and she said, well, you know, I was asking about between Latinos and the whites there. And she said, well, there's tension, you know, and they're separate. We're nice to each other. He goes, but we don't really do many things together socially, you know. And he goes, You know, and she was telling me, yes, her hope, part of her hopes, I guess, to answer the question more directly, was to go to college. And she was going to try to, I forgot where, some smaller college just northeast of here. She was going to try and go, and she wasn't sure if she could afford it. But then, the interesting thing was, I talked to her little brother, who was like the third or fourth grade. And with him, he said, oh, we all play together. You know, it's, he goes, there's no problems. And again, it just told me something about the, just how with age comes this, sometimes this, these tensions, whether they're real or not, whether they're imagined or perceived or learned, that, again, this young kid was just so adamant that, well, we all get along great. We all are good friends. And she was already leaving high school, experienced so many tensions with non-Latinos. So, I mean, I don't know if that really answers your question in terms of aspirations, but it's, I think it's, I found that, in fact, it's another observation, though, is that with the really young and the elderly, there's oftentimes less tension. I felt like what I learned from some of the elderly was that they'd seen so much change in their lifetime that they saw immigration as this recurring thing that, you know, wasn't going to change. It wasn't really a threat. For some of them. And with others, it was. I mean, there were certainly, again, and also in Melrose, the police chief there, I interviewed him, and he told me that, he said, well, he goes, yeah, we do, our, we, you know, they will get calls, and they're wondering why, you know, these guys are sitting on their stoop. And I'll go tell them, it's like, look, it's hot inside, you know. Why don't you wave to them and say hi? Maybe they'll say hi back, you know. And they're probably just, you know, looking at you just to, you know, to communicate. And so he said that, you know, a lot of times you have to do things to alleviate the tension, but it's really just about helping people get to know one another.
What is your parents' immigration story?
It would be my grandparents.
Okay.
My grandfather on my father's side came over in about 1901. And my other three grandparents came over, you know, between 1910 and 1912. And they came over as a direct result of the Mexican Revolution, wanting to flee the turmoil there. And they came to Texas and worked a variety of things, from being cotton pickers to eventually, I guess they all met each other and settled down in Houston, and my grandfather, my father's side, worked in the shipyards. My mother's father worked as a bricklayer, and we grew up in Houston. I was thinking today, somebody circulated a story, I guess, before Mitt Romney withdrew his candidacy about his Mexican immigrant past, and that he came over, his grandfather came over the same year as, in 1912, as much of my family did. I don't know if y'all know about that story, but anyway. Because his family had fled under duress because of the polygamous past to Mexico. And then when the war was going on, they no longer wanted to be there, so they came back probably as undocumented to the United States.
How ironic. Time for a couple more questions is all.
Just a quick question here then.
Sure.
First off, I really enjoyed your speech tonight, so thank you very much. My question is something I'm just puzzled about, and I hope you can express your opinion on this. This debate over immigration in the country, at least over the last year, year and a half, seems to really be a debate around Latino immigration. And I'm wondering, in your opinion, who's framing this debate? Is it the politicians, the media, or are there other forces at play in terms of this debate in the country now?
Well, personally, I think it's both. I think it's the politicians and the media. I think, you know, politicians have been exploiting. I think, my opinion, conservative voices in this country have been framing the debate around some issues for quite a while now. And since 9/11, I think the debate on immigration has narrowed down and to sort of key terms like, you know, homeland security, terrorism, these sorts of issues. And I think that as long as it's kept in this extreme level, you can create fear of others. And I believe that that's exactly what's been exploited. And so, again, the fear of others is the very definition of xenophobia. And so as long as you are able to tap into other people's fears about that, you know, you can manipulate it in all kinds of ways. I think the media, whether they realize it or not, have contributed to it because they tend to cover issues that are controversial, that are exploitable. And so, again, you get the coverage of these local anti-immigrant ordinances as this local struggle. And yet, again, I would like to see equal coverage given to all the places where people are getting along. You know, all those are very positive examples. And so, you know, again, it's the conflict that I think tends to sell newspapers and such. So I believe, you know, again, there's no real evidence that shows that the southern border has, you know, let in terrorists. There's nothing there to sort of point to it. I think, you know, we can talk about these issues, but we're not talking about them in realistic terms. I think even most Latinos would say, yes, we have a broken immigration system, but let's sit down on a table and have a genuine dialogue about what our needs are. I think, you know, we have in this country a dependency problem on foreign labor. So let's talk about how we fix that in a permanent way. But in order to bring that to find solution, you know, we should bring all sides to the table. And if we have to, we recognize that, you know, Mexico has, you know, economic problem. Well, let's bring them to the table like we would other countries about what might be solutions to that and how we could help participate in that rather than be exacerbated.
Question over here, and then a last question over here, please.
Just a comment as to the last question. I mean, I think it's focused on the Latino immigration just because it dwarfs the size of everybody else, and nobody else has a border to cross. The other one's got to swim across the ocean. That's a lot further than across the Rio Grande. The question that I had is one of the things that you see statistics that say that half the Latino students do not finish high school. And is that a fallacious statement? And if it's true, how do we alter that? I mean, it seems that this is the key to getting ahead in this society is education in this day and age. And how do we get kids to stay in school?
Well, I think we need to have another headliners on this one. No. Well, I mean, I do think that, you know, again, we can talk about students failing in the schools or the schools failing students. And there's ways to, you know, again, a genuine examination of that needs to occur. Nobody's proud of the fact that students don't succeed. But what is it, you know, what do students succeed in? I mean, do they succeed in things, in endeavors and in challenges that they feel they can embrace? And I think there's lots of ways in which the educational system is failing students by not making them feel accepted, by sending mixed signals. I mean, still today, you know, we have textbooks that don't include, you know, Latinos in them. They don't see themselves as part of this educational system. We set up roadblocks, and again, I know this is controversial, but for instance, you know, there are dozen states in this country that do allow undocumented students to pay in-state tuition. And we know here, we haven't been able to pass that here in Minnesota, but there are, you know, hundreds, if not thousands, of Latino students who can't go on to higher education because they can't afford it. And yet they've grown up here, lived all their life here, didn't make the active choice to come here. But without that incentive, that's also going to impact their decision to stay in school, because why should they? And I've heard that over and over. It's like if you high school education itself is not going to get students anywhere today. Higher education is becoming more and more out of reach because of the cost to students of all backgrounds, documented or not. So it's, again, we have to think about what are the incentives of people to participate fully in the educational system when it feels so out of reach in a number of different ways. That's a very short answer, and it's a lot more complicated question. And it involves all kinds of things like, you know, the kind of support they get at home, the kind of working class, the backgrounds they come from, because you'll find a correlation between, you know, class and economic success oftentimes, and the kind of jobs their parents are working, and so on and so forth. There's a lot of it's a really complex question.
It would be a good headliner's topic. Final question over here, Mary.
Yes. I had a question earlier about any generational differences that you noticed, but you really already addressed that. So my last burning question is, Are you still writing?
Well, just the other day, I set up my bike on my trainer so I could ride every day before I start riding. I'm not a winter rider. I found that on this trip, I'd rather ride in 117 degrees than 30 degrees. No. But I do plan, I've already planned several long rides with people this spring. And there's a man who contacted me when I was on my trip who's creating this Minnesota bike ride this summer, and it's going to be called We Are All One. It's a very multicultural ride designed to provide support for inner city kids to get bikes. So, yeah.
Ah, fantastic. So, Studs Terkel, Forrest Gump, Luis Mendoza, thank you very much. What an ambitious research project. It's fascinating. We envy you your trip, but probably not that long bike ride. I'm not sure how many of us could do it. Two quick items here. I want to call your attention to two upcoming events that might very well interest you. On February 26th, we're launching a new season of Great Conversations with a discussion of American democracy in dissent between Daniel Ellsberg and political science professor Larry Jacobs, who's in the news a lot these days. So it should be a fascinating conversation. Since 2002, we've presented more than 30 conversations between the university's outstanding faculty and a fascinating roster of these world leaders. So you'll find some information on the table about that, and I certainly do hope to see you there. The other thing I would tell you is that you may know this, but today marks the start of the Lunar New Year, most important national holiday in China, and perhaps it's an appropriate time to announce that our next headliner next month will be Dr. Yangwei Zhang, the director of University's China Center. So I hope you'll join us again on March 6th for what seems to be a very promising, wide-ranging discussion about the world's most populous country. Again, Louis, thank you so very much. This was a fascinating evening. And thank you all for coming.